Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. And welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Patty Friedman, author of Organized Panic, a novel. Poet Brad Richard, chair of the creative writing program at Lusher Charter School, talks about the Scholastic Writing Awards competition, along with Darius Christensen and Sophie Evans, two recent winners from New Orleans. Patty Friedman possesses one of the great comic voices of New Orleans, refined over a lifetime of close observation and weird experience here. She's the author of such well-known works as Too Jewish, The Exact Image of Mother, Eleanor Rushing, Secondhand Smoke, Side Effects, and many others. Her new book is the very smart and funny novel, Organized Panic. Patty Friedman, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Good to see you again, Susan.
Now, this is a great title. I love this epigraph. What is religion really, if not an organized panic about death? And that's from Quiet Company's Taylor Muse. So tell us about the many organized panics taking place in this novel.
Well, I actually haven't thought in any kind of depth about what appears in the book. I was thinking more in terms of the general concept, because it's such an assault in many ways on religion. And when I saw that phrase in The Humanist, I just had to have it, because it's such an oxymoron. You know, how do you have an organized panic? But in the novel, there's a character who, despite his upbringing as a secular humanist, has become a bold, pushy, I think greedy Christian evangelist. And to me, that is kind of another oxymoron. I mean, if he's so good-hearted and sincere and religious, why is he asking everybody to donate $20 a week?
Right. There is that. I mean, now, your protagonist in this book, Francesca Price, she is one of the most endearing heroines you've ever created. She's funny. She's smart. She's got a great relationship with both her mother and her daughter. She's tremendously talented and confident and ambitious, and she knows what she wants from life. She is a generous creation. Did you just have fun making her up and giving her everything?
God, it's so funny that you say that, because the first draft of the novel I gave to my eternal first reader, and she went through it and she said, "You cannot show this book to anyone else. Francesca stinks."
No.
She's just a terrible, terrible character. She annoys me. She alienates me. She's so self-righteous and so sure of herself, and she condemns everyone else. And then she said, "Mom." So it's my daughter Esme, who always is my first reader. And I guess, you know, naturally Esme would see the rotten mothers she has in the voice of Francesca. And I realized, yeah, okay, Esme's always right. And I looked at Cheska, and she is very self-righteous. I mean, she's a vegan. Let's just take that aspect of her secular humanism, which isn't even a necessary part of being a secular humanist. And the opening part of the book takes place over Thanksgiving dinner. And Francesca is saying what she's thankful for on Thanksgiving, and she's holding up her bowl of salad, which is made up of spinach and tofu, and saying how grateful she is for her food. And, you know, in the original version, I'm just letting Cheska go on and on about, you know, how happy she is and how grateful she is for her food. And Esme tells me, "You can't make her be so hoity-toity about this kind of attitude. You've got to tone her down." And so I went through, and I let Esme sit on my shoulder. I went through the whole book and calmed her down and let her you know, be kind, because I don't know, for all I know, that's the way the whole world sees me. And I didn't want to come through with that voice in the novel either, because, okay, I can go sit and hide in my house and nobody knows what I'm like, but I'm putting Cheska out into the world. And if I want people to enjoy the book, I better make her nice.
Well, I thought she was very nice. She might not be my ideal Thanksgiving guest, but, you know, and I think, oh, apologies to vegetarians, but I think few people are grateful for tofu. But nevertheless, she has confidence in her work. She has confidence in her painting. And you give her this artistic life that is very rich and successful.
Why not? Although it is a fine line to walk, I have to say, because she's the narrator. I always, when I have a female protagonist, and most of the time I do, you know, I'm writing in the first person. And in order to convey to your reader that your protagonist, Cheska, is a world-famous, highly acclaimed artist, she's got to be the one to tell you. And that was a fine line to walk for me, especially after Esme walloped me. And I had to let the reader know that she's very talented and very well known without making her offensive. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I give her circumstances. I mean, she's about to have an interview on PBS with an interviewer named Tever Suryante, which is kind of my mixed-up way of translating Tavis Smiley on PBS.
Now I'll always imagine him as Tavis Smiley. That's going to be fun.
I wanted to put the real person in, but my publisher said, no, you can't do that. You might, even though he, of course, is portrayed as a glorious human being.
And insightful.
Yes, yes. You know.
Yes. So Cheska's brother, Ronald, is equally well known, but in quite a different area. And his professional endeavor is so interesting. And it seems very Friedman-esque, I must say.
Well, Ronald Price started, of course, you know, in New Orleans. This will resonate, I suppose, with a lot of people. He started out cleaning up murder scenes. And I don't know. There might be a business like that for all I know in New Orleans, although I don't think it would be probably very lucrative here. And then one day, one of his personnel comes to a very tragic murder scene, and he starts praying over it. And all of a sudden, the word gets out that Price Services prays over murder scenes, and they become very, very well known. And so he changes his business to Jesus Cleanup.
And makes a fortune.
And he starts making a fortune. 7-state area, and his staff is running all over the place, cleaning up murder scenes and saying little prayers over them. And he's ordained all of his staff and so on and so forth. And so all of a sudden, Ronald has become an ordained minister, and he's feeling really wealthy. Now, Ronald is the kind of guy who, in New Orleans, wants to be wealthy and go to Galatoire's for lunch with his friends and send his kids to Newman and have all those accoutrements. So his and Cheska's mother, who's a pivotal character in the book, just doesn't believe that she could have reared her son in a completely secular household, and all of a sudden he is out there pounding the pulpit and, you know, screaming for Jesus. And so she makes a bet with Cheska. She puts up one of her Rodrigue paintings against one of Cheska's own paintings in a bet. She says, I know Ronald's a phony, and Cheska says, I think he must believe it. But, you know, that's the pivotal question in the book, is Ronald a phony?
Well, one of the best lines in this book is when they're making that wager, and her mother says, I'm not wagering the value of it, I'm wagering the joy of it, which I thought was so, so lovely. So great fortunes come into play, and things end up in court, and there are some legal battles going on. And you're reminded again about the way money is such a fulcrum for family discord.
Well, certainly in my personal experience it is. And I think it comes into play in a lot of the stuff I write. I know it certainly came into play in my very first book, which was a humor book called Too Smart to Be Rich.
Right.
Which I wrote when I turned 40 many lives ago, wondering why I was in New Orleans and had grown up going to Newman with all these people who became doctors and lawyers, and here I was, a struggling writer. But in my own family of origin, money was a weapon. It was a control force. Whoever had the money made the rules. Okay, my mother and my grandparents are deceased, And I thought that kind of attitude would have died. But now I have siblings who consider themselves valuable human beings because they've got money. And so I think, like in all my other work, there's a certain autobiographical element in this book. And by autobiographical, I feel like I have to explain to people that I don't mean, hey, I took an experience of mine and just wrote the story. I just mean that there's an emotional quality to it, or an emotional thread in the story that I put in. I should backtrack and say I am completely estranged from my siblings. And one of them is what I would call a flat-out failed rabbi. When I graduated from Smith College, he was 6 years younger than I was, and he came up there, and to get a little bit of attention for himself, he says, when I grow up, I'm going to be a rabbi. And I looked at him with my all the wisdom you can get with a Smith College diploma, and I said, do you believe in God? And he said, I don't know. And I said, don't you kind of think you ought to think about it? And I never asked him again, but I have this feeling that he hasn't even given that question another thought. He just wanted to have the title, you know, that he could walk around so that people would think that he had some kind of ethereal quality to him. Good grief.
And that is also a Friedman-esque kind of question and observation. But families are, you know, they're the seat of our longest held grievances and deepest hurts. And, you know, it's so interesting. They're endless fodder for fiction.
I know. And why not just thresh through them and see, you know, what really made them warped? Mm-hmm. If you don't have a warped family, forget about ever writing fiction.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mother. Thank you, Father. Thank you, former siblings.
We've been talking with novelist Patty Friedman about her most recent book, Organized Panic. You can meet her Thursday, September 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, or Tuesday, September 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Patty, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan, dear.
The panic is on. The panic is on. The panic is on. I'm manic and the panic is on. It started this morning without any warning. The panic is on. Bullets are flying and people are dying. The panic is on. My life is in shambles. Took too many gambles. My future is gone. There's pressure in my brain. I think it's a migraine. I'm manic and the panic is on. The panic is on. Manic and the panic is on.
Poet Brad Richard is the chair of the creative writing program at Lusher Charter School. He's the author of such well-known works as Butcher's Sugar and Motion Studies, and one of his passion projects is the Scholastic Writing Awards competition, which inspires and recognizes young writers in our region. That's what we'll be talking about today, along with Darius Christensen and Sophie Evans, two recent winners. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you, Susan. Great to be here.
Sophie, nice to meet you.
Hi there. And wonderful to be here.
You too, Darius.
Thank you. Nice to meet you too.
Now, Brad, tell us about these writing awards and how you got involved. You've been a teacher for a long time.
I have, and I have had students entering the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards for quite a long time. And about 8 years ago, I got interested enough to decide that we really needed to have a regional affiliate down here because it offers so many great opportunities for our young writers.
And that takes a lot of work, doesn't it, to put that together?
A little bit, yes, indeed. Yeah, we usually receive about 400 submissions a year for our competition. So organizing all that and getting our wonderful judges together and, of course, our great ceremony in the spring, the awards ceremony, too. And we're very proud to be hosted by the Greater New Orleans Writing Project here at UNO.
And how many schools does this involve in our area?
Our region is all of Southeast Louisiana. And I would say we usually have about 30 to 40 individual schools participating. And it's always amazing to see where people are coming from with their work. We have a lot from New Orleans and the Baton Rouge area, but then from St. Charles and across the lake and elsewhere. And I just want it to keep growing. I'd love to see more schools involved.
And submissions are just about to open up and will go on for quite some time, right?
That's right. This awards year, the submission period opens on September 13th, and the deadline is December 15th.
That's generous. That's lots of time to write,
yes,
isn't it?
Is. I mean,
Oh, now, Sophie, you received recognition in both poetry and prose last year, and you're a Lusher grad, and you're about to go on to college this year.
I am. I'll leave next week for move-in day on September 2nd, and I'm going to Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey.
And do you think you'll study writing there?
I know that I will. I'm absolutely committed to that, yeah.
Good influence. So what was it like for you to compete in these writing awards? What did it do for you as a young writer?
Well, the first time I entered was in eighth grade, and I was required to enter by my creative writing teacher, Eric Flint. I was actually failing that class because I didn't want to journal in the beginning of the class. I wanted to jump right into my projects. And so when Mr. Flint came to tell me that I had won a national medal, which was on my 14th birthday, I believe, he came and I saw him standing outside of my social studies class. And I was like, oh no, he's come to tell me that I'm failing his class and that I'll have to take it again. But he brought me outside in the hall and congratulated me. And it was so great. It was that sort of thing that you would think about when you're like, oh, maybe like that'll happen to me, but probably not. And it was great. And I got to go to New York that summer and see the awards ceremony there. And it was so encouraging to see so many young writers from across the country just get together and sort of celebrate the history of young people writing in America.
So I guess you didn't flunk the class after all.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Thank goodness.
So what did you bring to read for us today?
I brought an excerpt from my short story called Heat, which was part of my portfolio that won a silver medal with distinction this year. And before this excerpt, the main character has just played a bunch of very violent video games. Dylan, your mother says. When you don't answer, she says, Dylan, Earth to Dylan. Uh-huh. It's almost 5:30, young man. You abandon looking for the crackers in the interest of spraying cheese directly into your mouth. Your mom's eyes practically bug out of her head. After you swallow, you say plaintively, I'm hungry. Your mom, however, gets distracted from your crimes against cheese by the footage that's playing on the small white TV, three helicopters hovering over a fire. One releases a spray of chemical that seems to aggravate the flame rather than diminish it. Oh my God, Mom says, and clicks her tongue. Can we change the channel, you ask? Someone's left out the morning paper and you check your horoscope. It reads, true love is only ever one step away. Then again, so are abject failure and humiliation. You check on the horoscopes of everyone you love, too, because if there's a cosmic event planned, you don't want to be unprepared. Mom, because of Saturn, you'll undergo a spiritual change this week, but look out for a backstabbing friend. What? Your horoscope, Mom, you say, waving the newspaper. You're about to check Maddie's horoscope when your dad comes in. Hey, sport, he says to you. What you got there? Cheese, you say. Mom gives you a look. When does Katie and what's-his-name get in? Dad asks, checking his watch. 6:38, you say. And you better leave right now, because I heard on the radio that there was a pile-up on the I-55. 17 cars. The first one hit a deer, and the second one hit the first one. How horrible, Mom says absently. You know, I heard an adrenaline junkie offered to carry water into the fire and died. On the bottom of the TV screen, a message flashes that Coca-Cola is sponsoring a fire in Northwest Colorado, or sponsoring relief efforts, you're not sure.
Wow, Sophie. I have to ask, since you read that from your phone,
yeah,
how do you write? What is the most comfortable way for you to write?
I usually have to start writing on paper because otherwise I'll second guess myself too much. You know, the backspace is just too easy. It's right there. It's too tempting. So I'll usually start just free writing on paper and then I'll type up and organize. But most often I'll write the first part of the story and then the very end of the story and sort of fill in the middle.
And do you have a preference for poetry or prose?
You know, recently I've been on a prose kick, I guess for the past like year and a half. And, you know, I haven't stopped reading poetry. I really love poetry, but I just love all of the creative space that kind of prose lets me inhabit. You know, it's 17 pages I get to fill up with just me or whatever.
Wow. I'm glad to hear some people still write by hand. it makes me so happy. Now, Darius, you're a senior at NOCA this year.
Yes,
so writing's been part of your life for a while. You have to write for school. So do you write outside of school for pleasure or as well as your school assignments?
Yeah, I have been writing ever since I was in like fifth grade. And that was just a lot of horrible writing, you know, just to like, oh yeah, I want to do YA fiction. I want to do like the Hunger Games type stuff. And yeah. That was just some fun writing. But I started writing concretely since in eighth grade when I was applying to NOCA. That was the first time I ever wrote a decent poem. So I've been writing since then. And I think outside of school, a lot of it just comes out naturally. Either I have to force a poem out to turn it in or all that type of stuff. But when I'm outside of school, like on summer break, I think I write the most, my favorite works during that time.
Ah, yeah, when you have a lot of free mm-hmm. time to flow.
Yeah.
So what do you like to read the most?
I love Southern fiction. I love Southern Gothic mostly and African-American literature. My two favorite writers are Flannery O'Connor and Zora Neale Hurston. I love reading their work because it deals with so many current things that are happening now and things that were current back then. And with Flannery's, you just have to read between the lines to find the things that are current in our times.
Right. So what did you bring to read for us today?
I brought a poem that got recognition last year in the Scholastic Awards. It was like a gold key. It was nominated for a national award, but it didn't win. So this is titled Blueprint of the South. Leave it to the birds to be the ones that can fly. The mantis sits in her rare position. Notice her march along the balsam pear vine. There's been talk about the nigger with the gnat in his eye. He washed up one day on the coast of the town, eyes pecked out at the corners. Folks said he came from the southernmost tip of Mississippi. In the end, his parents wanted him to resemble mortar, so they poured his ashes where they claimed his name, along the roots of an oak. Now, if you would excuse me, I need to set out to find my own body being spat on and baptized in the sunrise. I've realized that I opened myself just to be embarrassed in front of you. People have noticed my change of gait, the way I lean to the side when the wind blows against my fragile frame. That's just the underbelly and the sternum arching to fill in the gaps left by my father's misunderstanding. Barnacled and black, my body rocks like a boat in the midst of a hurricane. Rots as the waves continuously peel the rusted paint off of me like scabs. This body, and many others like it, have been overused for centuries now and aren't allowed anger or flight, so in the end, I have to rehab past minds along with my own.
Oh, wow. When you said the title of that poem, Brad was sitting over there and nodding in recognition, right?
I mean, oh, yes.
That's amazing. So what did that appreciation of your work mean to you? Because that's a very personal, deeply felt poem.
Yeah, I don't know how to take recognition like that. I love when people feel my poetry, mm-hmm. but I want to connect with people outside of writing. I want to connect with people with my writing. And I think that since I've grown so much and I really didn't start off, you know, like Emily Dickinson or someone huge, I didn't really think people would connect with it. And now that I'm seeing with like the Scholastic Art and Writing Award and many other contests, I think that it is still a shock and it is still inspiring and just beautiful that people connect with my writing. Like a writer from New Orleans, they're connecting with my stuff. I just think that's kind of shocking. It's kind of awkward because I'm like, thank you. I don't know how to take compliments.
Better learn.
Thank you. I just think that it's cool.
Brad, don't you feel just proud when you look at these two? My gosh.
Of course I do, yes. And as long as I've been doing this, still, when we are reading through the submissions and I come across something by a student I've never met, it just blows my mind. It's one of the best experiences of my life.
It's thrilling.
To discover that new talent.
You're bringing along the next generation.
Yep.
You know, something else. We've been talking with Brad Richard, Sophie Evans, and Darius Christensen about the Scholastic Writing Awards. For more information, check out artandwriting.org or the Facebook page for Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana. The submissions open September 13th and go through December 15th. Brad, keep up the good work. Sophie, Darius, congratulations and thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Former Governor and Congressman Buddy Romer discusses and signs Scopina. his memoir of his early years, Tuesday, September 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. Christopher Kelly discusses and signs America Invaded, a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil, Tuesday, September 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Bloodjet Poetry Series presents Fiction Night with Michael Jeffrey Lee and Chin Sun Lee, Wednesday, September 20th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Today's guest, Patty Friedman, discusses and signs An Organized Panic, a novel, Thursday, September 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Friedman appears again, along with M.A. Harper, author of Things That Can Fall, Tuesday, September 26th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Dogfish Reading Series presents Niecy Shaw, author of Everfair, and poet Shayna Monet, Thursday, September 21st at 7 at 2448 North Villery. The Joan of Arc Project presents its 8th annual Salon de Jeanne d'Arc, Saturday, September 23rd from 9:30 to 5 at the Woldenberg Arts Center at Tulane University, featuring Joan of Arc scholars Stephanie L. Coker, Dale Sugar, and Tara B. Smithson. NOLA Paracon, a literary festival featuring a dozen local writers and editors discussing paranormal romance, takes place Saturday, September 23rd from 10 a.m. to 4:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The festival is free of charge and registration is not required. Here's the schedule. 10 a.m., welcome. 10:15 to 11, Indie Awesome, Indie Publishing 101, with authors Amanda Langlois and Rue Cantrell with moderator Gillian Zane. From 11:15 to noon, Clichés and Paranormal, Too Much or Not Enough, with Eden Butler, Julie Wetzel, and Alexandra Weiss. Moderator, Lila Felix. There's a lunch break at noon, and then at 12:45, Crossing Those Wicked Genre Lines with Pamela Koffler and Juliet Cross, moderated by Don Chartier. At 1:45 to 2:30, Realism in Fiction, Blending the Real with the Paranormal, with Sarah Tolzer and Marita Crandall, and moderator Elise Arden. Nancy Kavanaugh signs her young adult novel, Elsie May Has Something to Say, Monday, September 25th at 4 at Octavia Books. And here's something new. Ladder Library presents A Louder Literature, Monday, September 25th and Tuesday, September 26th from 6:45 to 8. It's an evening of participatory readings drawing on the early work of T.S. Eliot, Up Through the Wasteland. It will be accompanied by music and refreshments, and to volunteer or for more information, call Jacob Reisman at 504-596-2625. William Barnwell signs Angels in the Wilderness, Tuesday, September 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. One Book, One New Orleans presents an evening with Clint Smith, author of Counting Descent, the one book selection for this year. That's at the main library of the New Orleans Public Library, Thursday, September 28th from 6 to 7:30. Pamela Arsenault discusses and signs Guidebooks to Sin, her book on the guides to New Orleans' Red Light District Storyville, Thursday, September 28th from 6 to 7:30 at the Rosa Keller Library and Community Center. Errol and Peggy Scott Laborde and other contributors sign New Orleans the First 300 Years, Thursday, September 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, don't miss the New Orleans celebration of the annual event 100,000 Poets for Change, Saturday, September 30th at 8 at Cafe Istanbul. The theme this year comes from Gil Scott Heron's poem, We Beg Your Pardon, America. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.